Hey, this is James Ayler, host of the Fringe Voices show. Today I want to welcome back and thank Vinay Gupta for taking the time to speak to me again about the coronavirus. Again, Vinay Gupta is a Renaissance man and futurist interested in the technological transformation of society and commerce. Vinay has a strong track record of thought leadership in environmental and infrastructure risk, failing states, energy policy, and disaster management. He was also responsible for helping to launch the cryptocurrency Ethereum and is currently the founder and CEO of Materium, a technology startup for creating digital identities for the world of physical goods. Today we spoke about what exactly a pandemic is, the politics of this issue, importance of people on the front lines of this crisis, societal challenges with intergenerational families responding to the coronavirus, and some different scenarios of what may happen. Thanks again for listening, and if you wish to support the show, rate and review it, subscribe, and also consider going to my Patreon page. Hello, Fringe Voices listeners. Today we welcome Vinay Gupta once again. Vinay, how are you doing?
Not too bad. It's been a good weekend. I got a lot of sleep and I watched a bunch of dumb TV.
I'm glad you got a lot of sleep. I've been like not getting a lot of sleep at all. But you did mention before that we started recording that it's definitely important to get sleep during these times, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of general immunity, like being well rested is definitely a big part of not getting ill in normal times. I'm assuming this is going to work the same way.
And I think you're right. Yeah. And so I wanted to invite you back on again today because things are getting more real, especially in the United States. And I know in Europe as well. And I just kind of wanted you to take the lead on presenting maybe some examples of practical solutions that people can think about. Your Twitter account has been amazing with the amount of resources, and I'll link to a lot of the resources that you mentioned in the show notes. But I think the first thing that you did make a good point about is, what is a pandemic? Your definition of a pandemic now, because this is what it officially is now.
Yes. So this came to me last night when I was trying to explain what was going on. So to me, a pandemic is when society as a whole gets sick, right? You know, the coronavirus, it affects individuals. Individuals get sick, but society as a whole also gets sick. So many people are ill that it affects everything that we do. It affects the structure of the culture. It affects the economy. You know, the whole society has coronavirus. Because it's affecting the web of interconnections that ties all of us together into a society.
Okay. And then, you know, another thing, so I think that's a clear distinction of what a pandemic is, and that's what's going on right now. And another thing that you had mentioned is the, and I think we need to start talking about this too, it was called the dartboard of death. It sounds like an ominous name, but maybe you could break it down for us.
It is an ominous name. I mean, so this is a round of work that goes back to my work on worst-case natural disasters. I was doing a lot of this work for the U.S. Department of Defense. There's a project there called Star Tides, which I think now runs out of George Mason University, Humanitarian Relief Network stuff. So what we were looking for was a way of handling like refugee camps, right? If you're going to build a refugee camp in some climate, how do you know that you've got all the right equipment? How do we know that we have the right tents? How do we know that we've got the right food? How do we know that we've got the right medicine? Just how do we know that we've got all the bases covered? And traditionally, this had been done by having experienced people just sit down and figure that stuff out. But what I wanted was a methodology that would allow non-specialists to work together to figure these things out and to get the same kind of results that you would hope for from experts. So if you think of like small towns in America, you might have the hospital administrators, you might have the chief of police, you might have, you know, a representative of the governor's office, you might have the school superintendents, and, you know, everybody, you know, the folks that are running the hospitals, you get all those people together and you sit down and you have a conversation about what you need to do and how everything's going to work. And at the end of that, you want to walk out with the same kind of planning that you would have gotten if you had had an expert in the room with you. And so it was this idea of like how much of the mental model that is inside of the head of the expert can be written down as a methodology that people that are thrown into the crisis without extensive preparation can use to get similar results to what you get for an expert. And so this model is officially called Simple Critical Infrastructure Maps, and informally is known as the dartboard of death, because what you're left with at the end of it is a dartboard-shaped graph that shows you, or a chart, really, that shows you all the places where you have risk exposure. It shows you your risks. It allows you to write down on this chart where all your countermeasures are. So if your risk is, you know, we risk getting pandemic flu from our kids being at school, or coronavirus, sorry, I keep calling it flu. You know, you risk getting coronavirus when your kids go to school. You now have some decisions to make. Are we going to take the kids out of school? Are we going to decontaminate the kids when they come home? Who's going to go pick them up? And it just allows you to systematically go through every area of your life, just detailing out what your exposures are and how everything is going to work. And it's quite methodical. I've come under a lot of pressure over the years to give it a nice, hopeful name, like, you know, the Wheel of Life instead of the Dartboard of Death. But to be honest, the process of doing this kind of planning is so frightening that I kind of feel like people deserve a fair warning before they start.
That's a good point.
Right? I mean, have you done it yet? Have you done it for yourself?
You know, I've been starting to do it because we did talk about this last time with, you know, the heat and the cold and all of that and illness. Mm-hmm. But I'm lax and not preparing more for it. So I think this is a good reminder that I do need to do it.
I mean, as you work through that thing, it's on resiliencemaps.org. You can download a document there called Dealing in Security. Okay. ResilienceMaps.org. So as you start filling this thing in, it is scary as hell because it makes you aware of all the places where you've got exposure to the, you know, risks of the world. And that process is quite frightening because it makes us aware of our interdependence with other people. And this is where the pan in pandemic really hits home, which is that every single person that you are dependent on to maintain your quality of life and your safety, every single one of those people is also exposed to the same pandemic risk that you are. Some of them worse, some of them less so, but we really are all in this together. And so doing this exercise makes people acutely aware of that interdependence. And it also brings up lots of issues about the people that we don't normally think about. So our delivery people or our garbage men or the, you know, orderlies in hospitals show up on these maps very, very, very clearly as being very important, because it turns out they are very important. It's just normally, for really bad social and cultural reasons, we don't think of those people as being important. Right. So it has a very strong tendency of revealing what's hidden to people in a way that's often initially quite disturbing and then is very liberating and empowering. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely one of these things where it tends to be you go down and then you come back up the other side.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, please.
No, and I was just going to say that you have made a lot of good points about like delivery driver or delivery people and, you know, people that we don't necessarily think about and how they are on the front lines right now of this pandemic.
And I mean, this is something which is very, it's bred into our culture, right? When I take an Uber, if I say to my friend, when is the car coming? You know, I'm not really thinking about the driver. I'm thinking about the car. Right. And I could very easily instead say, when is the driver coming? And it just is a question in your head, is the critical factor in the Uber the fact that it's a car or the fact that there's a driver? Like, which one of these is necessary? Actually, it turns out to be both of them. But out of general respect to another human being, we should probably think that the important part of that story is the driver, not the car. See what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, right.
And all of those little mental glitches kick you right in the knees when you start trying to do things like pandemic preparedness, because all of those are tiny little blind spots where a problem can slip through. Because if you're not thinking about the humanity of the Uber driver, you're also not thinking about the infection status of the Uber driver.
Right.
You see how this works?
Yeah, definitely.
Right. And that really does, you know, tear off a mask, because it reveals a whole bunch of sort of existing structural problems inside of our society, which at the point where you get into pandemic country, those little existing structural problems flare up as big problems. We all sort of knew that the Amazon workers were getting a really raw deal from the company and they were being worked into the ground. And now we're putting gigantic, like, permanent Crispus level load on Amazon in an environment where if one of those people is sick, comes into work when they should say home, sneezes all over a bunch of boxes, you could kick off an entire new branch of pandemic. And you're not in a position where you can say that that's the worker's fault or Amazon's fault. It's the system's fault. We demanded low prices. They delivered the low prices. Suddenly, safety and workplace infection control was more important than cheap. And we didn't retool the deal where we started to treat these workers with a ton more respect because now we need them to do a safety critical job. Right? All of this stuff is going to have to get sorted out because we're going to be in this condition for a while. And it's not like the government just sets the rules of the game and then everybody plays by those rules. In America, in the UK, in the rest of Europe, this stuff is largely negotiated. We don't have the kind of authority that can just dictate a new structure for the society. We have to hash this thing out the slow way, which on one hand makes our societies free and open and very sort of durable, but in the other way, it slows us up at the beginning of a crisis. So as we work through this stuff, you know, it's really important to remember that this whole thing is about people, and it's about understanding where you are interdependent with people in such a way that their problem is your problem, which is to say their infection is your infection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one thing that I did follow up on when we spoke the last time, my personally speaking, is that I did talk to my building about, you know, how are we going to handle this epidemic or pandemic, and then how are we cleaning surfaces and things like that. I did get some positive responses, but also some, you know, sort of the negative responses as well. But what are some ways that individuals, and we did touch upon this a little bit last time, but what are some practical ways besides social distancing that individuals can take control of their lives as this pandemic starts to proceed?
So you need a super clear model of what is happening. And unfortunately, there's a lot of mental cost involved in getting that model, and there's a lot of mental cost in maintaining it and keeping it current. So right now, my understanding is that we're going to be looking at conditions until one of two things happens. The first thing is that we develop a vaccine or an effective treatment, and it goes from being extremely dangerous to being relatively manageable. And you get slightly different outcomes if it's a vaccine than if it's a treatment, but one way or the other, you get into a condition where this thing is medically controllable, and we go back into a pain where it's like any other infectious disease that we've got a reasonably good lock on.
Okay.
That's track one, right? Track two is that we fail to get that kind of control of the situation, but basically, you know, so many people have had the disease and now have some or a lot of immunity to it that society kind of goes back to normal, and the people that haven't got it yet are still going to have serious health problems if they get it some of the time, but the hospitals will have gone back to normal because we're well over the peak, and it's still a problem, but it's a problem for a relatively small percentage of the population, and the virus tends to die out because most of the time when it tries to jump from an infected person to another person, the other person it jumps to more than half of the time has already had the disease, and the virus dies on their skin.
Mm.
You see? So these are our two exits from the structural problem that we have right now. Either it goes back into the medical thing, or our sort of immune systems collectively figure it out. And at that point, so many of us are immune that the virus can't really get a toehold. And the ones that have never had it and aren't immune are generally not going to be exposed to the virus because it just can't spread very well. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
These are the two strategies. So in the meantime, then you've got the social distancing stuff, which is the infection control mechanism. And the infection control mechanism is all the social distance stuff and all the rest of that.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yep.
Yeah. So social distancing is what we're doing in the meantime. And then on the outside track, you've got the people who are running towards getting us vaccines and antiviral drugs and similar medical approaches. And on the inside track, you've got the kind of long, slow grind towards so many people have had it that nobody else is going to get it. Very, very, very tricky, right?
Right.
So now you've got to start thinking, what do we do from now until then? And the answer, generally speaking, is just, you know, structure your life in such a way that your risk is minimized. Now, here we have to talk about class again. We have to talk about politics, because the things which will prevent us responding correctly to this are political problems, right? Mm. pre-existing areas where we've got fuzziness called root causes of the issues. So right now there are basically, there's a new class divide opening up, which is the people that can work from home and the people who can't work from home. Right? If you're work from home people, then you work from home, your exposure to the outside world is minimized, you get your food and so on delivered, and life is weird because you can't go to the office, but it's sort of a bit like permanent vacation.
Right.
I mean, okay, it's a vacation where you still have to work, but the whole thing has this weird, slightly dreamlike quality that you get up in the morning and you don't go to the office.
Yeah, I'm experiencing that right now, yeah.
And a lot of us are. If you are of the work from home class, caste, however you want to refer to it, social standing, your experience of the pandemic is completely different than if you're somebody that has to go to work to do their job. So if you work in the medical field, the medical arena, you don't get work from home, right? You get, unless you're doing some kind of back office desk job, you get turn up in a place with tons of infected people and, you know, pray that you don't accidentally rub your eye.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
Frontline direct exposure to high risk areas versus I'm staying here in the comfort and security of my own bubble. Right?
Right.
And this is a stark class divide. Right? This is two completely different experiences of what this whole pandemic situation is going to be like. If you're somebody that's making minimum wage and your job is to turn up, you know, in a factory and pack boxes on a production line with 50 other people, then, you know, your direct exposure is enormous. And until the government steps in and stops people going to work, then those jobs are going to continue there. And unless the government steps in and does things like prevent people being kicked out of their houses for not paying rent, how are these people going to stay home? And in America, you want an additional layer of risk here, which is, do these people have medical cover? You see?
Right. Yeah. Which is what a lot of
people listening to. This is the pre-existing social structural problems get massively amplified by the presence of the pandemic. So for you and me, right, we are in a position where work from home is a thing we can do. I've been working from home for several years because I'm doing a startup and basically an office was an unneeded expense most of the time.
Sure.
Right. I've got a little, there's an office, like a rickety old office building near me where I've got like a one room office that I use because I've got like huge whiteboards down there and a conference ring rig, but like the actual team will assemble there maybe once in 2 weeks in normals function, and I just go down there and that's my thinking space and it's a place where I do all the writing and, you know, that's kind of my, that's where the heavy lifting gets done. But it's not like I'm going into an office filled with people, right? That's my space, that's where I work. Instead of doing it in a bedroom in my house, I do it in a little office down the way. So that sort of setup is a position of enormous privilege in the best of times, but in a position where you have a pandemic going on, that's absurd privilege. You know, like I am lucky, right? And it's not even really about money, right? I mean, I live I don't want to say a frugal life, but like, you know, I rent an apartment in a very unfashionable part of London. I share with two other guys. You know, this is by no means the lap of luxury, but it's just I'm in a position where I managed to get my life to work quite nicely in a way that I was really comfortable and happy with. And that position of privilege is about having had freedom more than about having money. But that freedom has given me a lot of adaptation capability in the position that we're in.
It makes sense.
Think? But if I had a boss breathing down my neck, if I was doing exactly the same kind of work that I do right now, but I had a boss breathing down my neck that expected me to turn up in the city of London, work on the 24th floor in an open plan office with 600 people, I could be getting paid four times what I'm getting paid now, and my quality of life would be much lower and my risk exposure would be much higher. I wouldn't have control to say, I'm not going to do that. See what I'm saying?
Yeah, it makes total sense, especially when you're talking about the different classes now. And then it's not like you're saying, you gave some concrete examples. This isn't necessarily depending on money either.
No, it's not depending on money, but it is depending a lot on, you know, freedom and to some degree privilege and power.
Right.
It's a very you know, you're in a powerful place if you could say, I'm not going to expose myself to this risk and you can't make me. Right? You're in an even more powerful place if you say, I'm not going to expose myself to this risk and nobody's even trying to make you. Right?
Right.
So, you know, this is really important, right? Now, the people that are on the hard end of this are people that have to go to work. They have it bad. People that have to go to work in hospitals, for them, this is World War II, dude. Right? If you're a hospital staff, you're expecting to spend 6 months watching people die in corridors because you don't have another ventilator or another bed.
Yeah, it's horrible.
You read any of the pieces coming out of Italy where medical staff in Italy are just like, you guys have no idea what's happening. What in hell's name are you thinking? Why isn't everybody at home with, you know, plastic tape over their letterbox?
Oh, yeah, it's awful.
Right? And it's completely predictable that if we don't do the social distancing stuff in a full-on, radical, extreme way, we will wind up with those kind of results.
Mm.
Right? I mean, you were telling me the National Guard was doing food deliveries in New Rochelle, right?
Right. The National Guard's in New Rochelle, yep.
Right? So, you know, like, that's not going to stay in New Rochelle. Right?
That's right.
That condition is... It's not going to be confined at one place. That sort of trouble is coming to a lot of places.
I think another interesting thing is that there's like a lot of hot pockets of where this is happening, specifically in the United States, where like it's Seattle, New York, a couple of other areas like Ohio, I think, is another one. And like for example, my parents live in Arizona. There's not like a lot of cases there yet. So that's kind of an interesting thing as well that's happening. But wouldn't you agree that it's probably going to spread to all of those places anyways?
I think it will be patchy. You know, it depends a lot on infection control measures. It depends a lot on dumb luck. You know, what we saw with the 1918 flu was that depending on when you closed things like theaters and how much social distancing you did, my friend Lucas prefers the term contact reduction, which I think is nicer. Contact reduction. depending on how much contact reduction you did, you had half of the death rate in some places than others. So I think it will be very patchy. You know, if people in a little mountain town act like nothing is wrong because they don't let strangers in anymore and then one of them turns out to get it, then everybody's going to get it, right? Even if you're in a place where you don't think it is, you still have to maintain precautions, because maintaining precautions is how you go from not having a lot of it to having a lot of it.
That makes sense, yeah.
You know, it's pretty, you know, you just, it's almost like wildfires, right? If you've got an enormous pile of dry wood, eventually something will set it on fire.
Right. You know?
If you just have a huge number of people interacting with each other as if there's no flu in the environment, no coronavirus in the environment, eventually somebody will talk to somebody who talked to somebody who had the damn thing, and you'll have a contagion. And then it will run like wildfire. Right? So, you know, even in the areas where you think you're secure, you have to maintain precautions, because nowhere is so secure that nobody who ever breathed on anybody ever got there, except maybe a nuclear bunker. So, I want to talk a little more about this whole sort of the categories of how people are, you know, under pressure and under exposure. Okay. So the other two super hard cases, right? So condition one, you can work from home. Condition two, you have to go to work, right? Condition three, you're in medical. You're in medical. Oh my God, I feel for you now, and it's going to be so much harder later on. You know, we really ought to be restructuring society as if our medical people are like the new class of special forces guys. If you're a hospital person, you are deserving of the same kind of respect that we've traditionally reserved for elite combat units, because frankly, their death rate could be much the same as soldiers in wars if we don't figure out effective treatment regimes for keeping our doctors well. And it's not just the doctors, it's the nurses, right? The nurses are going to be taking enormous amounts of the load on this, because most of what you can do for these patients is nursing care, right? Behind that, you have all the orderlies and the cleaners, and the cooks, and all the rest of the, you know, kind of facilities staff that make hospitals possible, all the receptionists and all, you know, all of that entire structure. Everybody involved is going to be going to work in a building where you know that half the people inside of that building have coronavirus, and many of them are not going to survive. And as far as I can tell from the numbers, it's going to be the condition for the next 6 months. Wow. Once it starts and the hospitals max out. Yeah. Because, I mean, if you look at the reports in Italy, the pandemic is not contained in Italy. They're still getting more cases pouring in. Hospitals are already maxed out. The medics are screaming. Their head of coronavirus control died of coronavirus.
That's right.
It turns out having a 70-year-old guy in that position was putting him at a lot of risk. We're going to have to start putting like 25-year-olds in charge of things. At least if they get sick, they get well again, and then they can continue to do the damn job.
Yeah.
Right? So, lots of structural change. So, medical condition 3. Condition 4 is the people that have old parents. Right? If you've got old parents, you have some super hard decisions to make. Right? Again, if you've got old parents, you've got a car and you work from home, you know, you get into your car pretty sure you're not carrying the virus. You go and visit your parents. You bring them their food or their groceries or whatever it is that you took out of your storage so that you know that those things are safe. You hand them to your parents. You say hi. You give them a hug very carefully, and then you come home again. Right? That's the lucky, that's the privileged condition. If you're in a position where you're working a job, you don't have control of your own infection status in nearly the same way that you would if you were working from home, then you have to decide whether you're going to go and see your parents and help them take care of themselves, or whether in doing that you're endangering them by possibly taking a virus into their home.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Right? And this is, I mean, that's the living choice of, I don't know, tens of millions of Americans?
Oh, yeah. And I know even...
What do we do in that situation?
Yeah, totally.
You're going to say, personally speaking?
Oh, personally speaking, yeah. I mean, I don't live near my immediate parents, but my wife's family, we're trying to gauge this decision too, because they're older, they're susceptible. They have a granddaughter. So it's like, how do we juggle this? It's a lot of complicated decisions right now.
It's a lot of complicated decisions, and there's very little clear clinical guidance.
Right.
So we're asking ordinary people to take responsibility for a bunch of life or death decisions where the medical science is still not sufficiently certain that the government's willing to give an opinion.
Right.
You know, how much stress is this? This is all the stress in the world because you're making life or death decisions about people that you love in a position where the experts won't give. I'm not happy with this. I have no dependents. I have no kids. Both my parents are already dead. The only old people that I have particularly close relationships with live on other continents. The people that I really worried about have largely died in the last few years. Like, you know, I had an old friend, Peter Feltham, who was really important to me in some really deep ways. And Peter died a while back. So, you know, I'm in a position where I don't have that as a load in my personal life. But one of the people I share my apartment with has parents that live a couple of miles from here. Right. And, you know, we're constantly trying to figure out, like, all right, how are we going to sort this out? My kind of sort of girlfriend lives with her parents, right? You know, because London is an expensive town. You can have like a real job and be like a career person still with your folks. And of these questions about do you turn up to work or not, you know, these are ass-kicking problems, right? Really, really ass-kicking problems. So, you know, if people have enormous angst about this and they're uncertain and they're scared and they're worried and they don't know what to do, that is exactly where we are right now. Because the people with the expertise are not giving us clear right direction on what we ought to do about this stuff. Right? Compare that to the Chinese example where the government just said, everybody go home, nobody's allowed outside, and we'll make sure that you don't die in your apartment. You know, that was kind of a different proposition.
It was, yeah. And there was, you know, people posting videos on TikTok. You know, they're just a lot of mass death going on, but people were also able to or almost refrain themselves from those tough decisions, I think.
in that the government kind of, I mean, this sort of defines authoritarian, right? The government made the decisions and told people what to do, and people bloody well did it.
Right.
But, you know, the price of freedom is that Americans get to make these decisions for themselves, because if you're in an authoritarian government and they get it wrong, and then they enforce their will on the population and an enormous number of people die, there's kind of nothing you could do in that situation, and now you're totally screwed.
Yeah.
So when they get it right, it looks great. And when they get it wrong, everybody's completely hammered. And, you know, how much faith do we ever have in the ability of governments to get things right?
Right. And then we have the additional thing of the, in the United States, and I don't know how much we want to get into politics, but, you know, we have the presidential election that's happening right now. And I know that a lot of, you know, the two candidates that are left are usually doing rallies or trying to get support. And now that is largely stopped as well.
And I mean, all of that stuff, you know, I'm less interested in kind of the current electoral politics, because in a sense, the political framework of the society doesn't change depending on who's currently, you know, the chairman of the board. The company is still in the same line of business, right? So the concern to me is more about class and structure than the specifics of exactly who happens to be in charge. I know whoever is in charge, it's going to make an enormous difference to the outcomes. You know, different measures will get prioritized and all the rest of that stuff. But at the end of the day, it's really the personal aspect of the politics that hits us on this. So,
right.
You know, old folks taking responsibility for your parents in a position where you don't know whether or not you're going to track a virus to them is a huge deal. People that have parents in care homes, you know, everybody is freaking out about the care home situation if they've taken a look at that. Because if somebody does bring an infection into a care home, it will be enormous. On the other hand, if they get really good at keeping infections out of care homes, everybody will be safe there, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe the staff start living there. I don't know. Let's see. Again, you know, somebody with real expertise needs to take a look at that. I don't want to do the analysis on that. I don't have all the tools I would need. Never worked in the care home business. Don't really understand what options they've got for managing it, you know. But I could tell that that's going to be a nightmare.
Right.
And then the other thing is schools. So, thank God. I mean, seriously, thank God. One of the phenomenal strokes of luck that we've had with this thing is that it doesn't kill children.
Right.
Right? My understanding on the latest data is that nobody that's been infected under the age of 9 has died.
Yeah, which is very thankful.
Teenagers seem... Oh, my God. Can you imagine if this thing also killed kids at the same rate it kills old people?
We would be talking a whole different scenarios, and it would be a totally different conversation, right?
Because it would run through schools, and then all the kids would die. Oh my God, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I can't, you know, we can't help that for, you know, a 7-year-old kid to die is a completely different tragedy when a 77-year-old person dies. You know, 77, there is this tendency, like, well, you know, they can't run, what were they really going to do in the next 10 years? When a 7-year-old dies, it puts a hole in an entire community.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, there is a brutality that, unfortunately, you know, we'd consider the deaths of the old to be less tragic than the deaths of the young. But at the end of the day, anybody that has children right now is just like, oh, my God, thank God it's not going to take my kids.
Oh, yeah.
Right. But then you've got this intergenerational thing of, you know, your kids can still get it. They can still infect you. They can infect your parents. They can infect you, and then you can infect your parents. And are we going to take the kids out of school? Are they going to leave the kids in school? There's all this faffing around about, you know, we want to keep the kids in school because this is where we feed them. You know, can you not just hire some teenagers with motorbikes to go and deliver food to their houses if food is the problem? Like,
yeah, there's got to be.
You know, there's just layer by layer by layer by layer. Right?
Right.
So all of this stuff, I want to say really clearly, is political. Right? It's all political.
And I think, you know, one thing that we've talked about is also, like, just having a lot of empathy as well for people. I think, I mean, no, social distancing, yes, that's going to, you know, flatten the curve, as they say. But I think as you're expressing too, is let's have some empathy and some kindness towards one another too, because there is going to be a lot of people that are extremely affected by this, if not already. And then, you know, I don't know if we really want to get too deep into this, but I know you had mentioned that there's like boomer side going on Twitter and things like this, but empathy and kindness at a time like this is needed.
Well, I mean, the millennials are kind of in a bad position, right? I mean, as you say, I think this is a can of worms that I'm content to leave largely lidded right now, but at least let's read the label. You know, the really young kids, the kids that are basically born after 9/11, have grown up with 20 years of war. They've grown up with a federal government that has been really quite brutal in the way that it's handled all kinds of issues, both foreign and they've grown up with a world largely thought of America as a place that used to be great and then went off the rails at 9/11 because it went back into militarism in a way that was largely seen as being destructive and unproductive. So they've grown up in a totally different world, economically, culturally, politically, socially, and even spiritually, from the people like me, where, you know, when I was 20 or 18, right, when I turned 18, we got world peace broke out. You know, the Berlin Wall collapsed, the economy boomed in the UK, then I came to America and the economy boomed four times harder. From 20 to 30, it was just a ball, you know, and then it hit. Whereas for these kids, they're just like, the world has always sucked. For us, all that we've ever seen is suck. And now we've got even more suck. And what they see is the people of my generation and older, who they perceive to be very, very rich and very, very powerful, particularly the people in their 60s, who are allowing the kids to struggle and struggle and struggle and squeezing them to death with student loans and all the rest of this nonsense. So, you know, for them, you know, they kind of naturally or unnaturally, some of them, at least feel like this is basically just kicking the older generation in the teeth, and the old bastards deserve it. Mm-hmm. You know, when we needed you, did you loosen the purse strings? Did you sort out the student loan thing? Did you guarantee us healthcare? No, you did none of these things. Don't expect us to cry about this. And I feel like that is, on one hand, kind of totally outrageous. And on the other hand, I don't think anybody can deny that the younger generation has gotten completely shafted and society as a whole has done very little to assist.
True.
Right? I mean, I grew up with much better conditions than kids are growing up with now in terms of things like their access to education, right? I think my entire student loan was about, I don't know, £1,200 or something like that. Wow. And, you know, for kids who are, yeah, I mean, it was because prior to that, we didn't even have student loans in the UK. We used to pay people to go to university. Then it was free. Then we started having them take out loans to pay for their rent and food. And then in America, they have to take out huge loans to pay for their education. And let me tell you something, right? If everybody in a room has paid $30,000 to be in the room and there are 120 of them, why is the person teaching the room also making $30,000 a year?
Right.
Right? Like, you know, if the grad student who's teaching is making 30 grand and the student is paying 30 grand, in theory, you could have one grad student per student. So where the hell is the money going in that system?
Yeah, right? that's totally true.
Totally true. And because the whole thing is, you know, because nobody really gave a shit about what was happening to these kids, because everybody just assumed education was expensive and that's how it was going to be, you know, there was no massive outrage to go there and audit the goddamn system, figure out who was taking advantage, and stop them predating on the kids.
Right. Right?
Every single one of the things which is flaring up here is an existing political structural problem. And when you put the society under stress, all of the existing problems suddenly erupt into a new class of problems. Right? So this is kind of the lens that I'm looking at this through is, you know, elder care has been a big problem in the US. Underfunding of school systems has been a big problem in the US. Access to healthcare has been a big problem in the US. Food insecurity has been a big problem in the US. Rural areas not getting proper support as they deindustrialize has been a huge problem in the US. every single one of those big problems now intersects with the pandemic, and all of those problems, if it was a bad thing before, now you add a pandemic to it, now it gets much worse.
Yes, it makes sense.
Makes sense, right? So, you know, this is the predictive model. If you understand that that's kind of where we are, then you're taking an accurate model of our political strains, and then you're adding the flu to it. And this is not politics in the sense of party politics. This is politics in the sense of who pays for who. You know, are your schools going to close? Who's going to take care of your kids? Do you have enough money that you can afford to work from home and have people bring you food? Or are you the person that has to go out there in the world, bring the food? You know, are you having to turn up in an institutional setting? Even if you're a banker, if your boss insists you come into the office, you know, do you walk away from your job? Are you underwater with your mortgage? All the way through, it's this deeply interwoven matrix of cause and effect, freedom and control, you know, rights and responsibilities. And it's that matrix that all of the moral decision making and the ethical decision making in the pandemic attached to. You know, that's the real battleground of our lives on this stuff.
Right. And then I don't want to take up too much of your time. And also, I did want to keep this fairly short. But one thing, and I appreciate this conversation that we've had so far. I think it brings to light many issues and things that people are probably talking about already and a way to move forward. One other thing I wanted to talk about, though, is just like maybe two concrete examples of practical things that could happen. I know in New York City, like if the internet, and I'm trying not to be outrageous here, but if the internet did fail, there also is like a community a community internet called NYC Mesh. And I know there's like other examples of this out here. Do you have like another like example, practical example of when, like if delivery stop, then how are people going to get food, that type of thing?
Yeah, okay. So what we're talking about here is the general bucket of things that people call collapse, right?
Right.
Right. So I used to work on failed states, right? I mean, I'm largely a theoretician in a think tank context, but I was a failed state guy. So I don't think that this virus is particularly likely to cause substantial interruptions in the function of the core infrastructure of society. I think governing, governance, policing, fire service, electrical, internet, gas, water, all of that stuff, I don't foresee much chance of that stuff going wrong systemically, right? You might get local problems where, you know, some particular power plant winds up with somebody in the cafeteria, sneezes on a bunch of things, turns out and everyone gets ill at the same time, and you have a temporary outage or you have to ship in workers from elsewhere to run it. And, you know, I'm not saying there won't be a struggle to keep things together, but I think that the current situation, it's unlikely to be more than occasional patchy outages here and there.
Okay.
If this was the middle of winter, I would have a completely different opinion about that. Because keeping everything running in the cold states in America in the middle of winter takes 100% effort from these folks. So if then you knock out a third of them because they all got the flu the same day, you're going to have real problems, right? But during the summer period, I don't think that these systems are substantially endangered.
Right. Okay.
Because, if you think about it, every time you get an enormous winter storm in some place like Minnesota, you know, you have a bunch of incredibly tough people, you know, driving in monstrous trucks to go and, you know, fix power transformers or pylons or whatever the heck it is they do, you know, halfway up a mountainside in snowshoes. That level of effort, and you've got a whole bunch of sick people, you're really going to have problems, right? But from now until the winter, I don't foresee a great deal in the way of infrastructure problems. And we didn't see it in most of the places that have already gotten kind of worse flu than we have here. Keep calling it flu. I'm going to have to switch that over. So,
I think that's a good distinction. Said,
yeah, I mean, it's, you know, best guess, right? I'm not, you know, I wouldn't make a guarantee about it, but like, you know, I'm not in a position where I'm recommending that people start, you know, buying diesel generators and all the rest of that, right? It's not that kind of situation.
Okay.
Now, bulk food is a different question, right? So we're already beginning to see, you know, Amazon coming under strain because everybody's just like, Amazon, bring me magic things, right? Amazon, fortunately, is used to enormous spikes in demand happening at Christmas. So I'm guessing that they got out the Christmas playbook and they're trying to figure out how to run it for 6 months. God bless Amazon. I mean, really, really, how much of a difference has it made in my life in the last month, being able to think about what I ought to do in terms of preparing and just pull the trigger and it turns up on my doorstep, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like, if I was, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. You know, it's just like, here we are. And it's simple stuff, right? Like, you know, I'm going to be spending way more time at home on calls, and I wanted a tripod mount to put my iPad in so that it was a little closer to head height, so I wasn't kind of looming over people when I'm talking to them on the call. 30 seconds, I go click, I go buy, $15, it'll turn up tomorrow, you know? And that, what to me, one of the most critical things that we can do is get Amazon, you know, to be able to deliver pharmaceuticals. Right. If we could provide that service, if they could get whatever licenses they need to basically integrate with the pharmacy system, I think that that will save an enormous amount of people being exposed when they're already ill. You know, if you're, you know, you need your whatever, your antidepressants, your antibiotics, you know, your hay fever medication, whatever it happens to be, anything that's a box of pills could be dropped into the Amazon system and moved around pretty painlessly if they had the right licensing and regulatory stuff. Insulin is a little harder. Insulin is always a super hot concern in these kind of situations where you've got supply chain disruption. Insulin's a huge deal. So all of this said, what I'm saying is I don't expect the grid services to go down. I do expect consistent, continuous duress in the heavy logistics systems, particularly for the kind of stuff which is coming over from China in sea containers. I don't think it's going to be any kind of issue in food. Again, I'd have to do a bit more checking, but I don't expect us to run out of food, particularly in America, where America is just a gigantic, enormous farm. You know, you've basically got two coasts separated by 3,500 miles of farm with a little bit of desert in one corner.
Yeah.
So I don't think food will be more than inconvenience, nuisance level things. And it's certainly well within the capability of the national and the federal governments to just, you know, airlift, you know, 2.5 million hamburgers to some corner that winds up with an unexpected food crisis. I just don't see there being big problems around food. I think the places where you're going to get the problems are around convenience items. You know, like, you run out of printer ink. Well, you know, okay, Amazon doesn't have any printer ink because the sea container with printer ink is currently sitting on a dock in China. Okay, where are we going to get the printer ink? Maybe this turns into, you know, maybe eBay winds up next in line after Amazon is the thing which becomes enormously busy. And it's just a whole bunch of people figuring out what they need and what they've got and selling off the additional stuff they don't need in their houses. Partly it make a little money while things are down, and partly it help people that need the stuff that they've got lying around. Could be a lot of that. But all of this, right, between now and when society has kind of gotten to its feet and really figured out how to roll with the punches on this stuff, in that initial period, there's going to be a whole bunch of herky-jerky weird outages as companies figure out how to adapt and as you get the kind of first wave of bad surprises. So I would say if you're like, I don't know what would be the kind of things, like if you've got something like eczema and you're very reliant on some particular cream because it really helps your skin, if it's non-prescription, this is the kind of stuff that people might discover goes out of supply pretty quickly. And then we have this awful problem of, if I buy a bunch of it to take care of myself, what happens if somebody else then can't buy it? And maybe the answer is honor-bound secondary markets, where the people that did stockpile things like that make sure that they keep some of it available on something like eBay, and then they can talk to people, figure out whether the need is genuine, and then sell it at cost. You know, like,
I
feel like we'll figure all this stuff out as we go, but it's important that we don't get into kind of scalping markets for these kind of things, because then what will happen is you'll get people that don't have eczema buying the damn stuff up and then keeping it in a cupboard and extorting people. And, you know, there's no way that's acceptable. So But, you know, if we're in a position where people who need these things do stockpile, we ought to be in a position where that shouldn't be cut end for those assets. We ought to be in a position where if somebody has stockpile more than they strictly need, they ought to feel strongly encouraged to sell some of it else in the same position. So I don't think that we're going to see large-scale problems in bulk supply. I think there'll be a bunch of twitchiness around it. You know, places where I foresee really big problems are, you know, what do you do with, you know, tens of millions of bored American children and teenagers who perceive no real risk to themselves for an entire summer?
Oh, yeah. You know, we're already dealing with, we've kind of stayed inside a lot, and our daughter is like going a little bit stir crazy. And it's like, yeah, what do we got to figure things out here? And especially with teenagers, too, like they're going to have, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. 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 And I mean, I think one approach to the teenager problem is we might just send them all camping.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea.
I mean, just have the Boy Scouts basically become a federal agency. Everybody ships their teenagers to the, you know, some enormous scout camp in the sky. You know, you've got a bunch of, you know, police officers and parole guys and other hard cases that have had the flu and are now immune, who basically just stand around making sure that the kids don't chew on each other too badly. And we just ship them out and let them party for a summer. Like, fine, okay, there is no adult supervision apart from these, you know, 15 retired, you know, cops that have had the flu and have gotten over it. And they're going to make sure that nobody's, you know, poisoning anybody with bad drugs or raping anybody. And we're not going to let you guys have duels like you wanted to. And, you know, maybe you wind up with some kind of large scale cultural response like that. Because I just don't think it's particularly plausible that you're going to be able to maintain, you know, containment with teenagers for half a year in summer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're going to sneak out with their bedroom windows. They're going to go party with their friends. They're going to come back, and then they're going to give flu to their entire goddamn family. So if we don't find an official way of letting the teenagers off the leash because they are relatively safe, I think that we will find extraordinary problems maintaining containment. And I don't know, you know, culture tends to fix these problems. You know, these are not really problems that are going to get solved one parent-child conversation at a time. It will be one of these things where a trend kind of forms, and that'll be how it sorts itself out. I think that, you know, this is where I really begin to stagger, because I don't have kids, so I've got very little insight into how that generation really works. I'm slowly slipping further out of touch, natural hazard being in your late 40s. But I just have a gut feeling that something productive will come out of that mess, but you ought to be prepared for it to look pretty weird compared to previous norms.
Okay. All right.
Because, how many teenagers are there in New York, and do we really expect them to all stay inside all summer?
Oh, no way, especially not in
the Bronx. It's no way, right? You know, they're literally going to sneak out of their bedroom windows, they're going to have big parties on somebody's roof, and then they're going to come back and pretend that nothing happened, and then you're going to discover that somebody there had the goddamn flu, and then half of them will get COVID, none of them will die, but the cluster around them will totally break containment in a huge slab of people.
Right.
Right? So, you know, if we don't figure out structurally safe ways of letting the people that are at minimal risk and are maximally prone to disobedience and partying, if we don't figure out how to let those people off the leash in a fairly safe way, what's going to happen is they're going to pretend they're on the leash, and then they're going to track the bug back with them. And anybody who thinks that we're going to solve this by nailing their windows closed has no idea what they're dealing with.
Exactly.
Right? It's like teenager. It will get water wound. So we got, you know, we just have to face all of this stuff. And sorry, no, go on.
No, I was just going to say.
It's the realism thing again, right? You know, if you're realistic about taking care of grandma, you also have to be realistic about, you know, what your 17-year-old kid is going to do now that they can't play football for the summer.
Yeah, I agree. I think we've had a great conversation about the ways in which individuals could minimize their risk. We've also talked about some different scenarios that could potentially play out. And it doesn't seem like you're indicating, and I would probably agree with this, even though I have absolutely no experience with this, that it's going to be an extreme model of like supply chain, extreme supply chain disruptions. But I just wanted to give you an opportunity before we close this out. Is there anything else that you wanted people to think about or know about?
Okay, so I want to distinguish between sort of rational concern and panic. You know, there's a lot of people being kind of down on panic, and we don't really have a good model of what very serious concern looks like that is not panic. Like, okay, I have massive concern about this. I'm going to stay concerned a long time. You know, I'm really worried and I'm going to act accordingly. There's a hashtag kicking around Twitter right now, which is high risk COVID-19. And it's people that have respiratory or immune issues basically saying, like, look, if I catch this thing, it's 70% likely to kill me. I really want you all to do social distancing.
Yeah.
Wow. Make sure that we don't wind up with so much of the stuff around that we get infected. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I mean, I have, you know, a bunch of lung damage from a pneumonia infection that I had in 2004, maybe. So one of the reasons I'm so fat is my metabolism just never really recovered from that thing. And you know, I would estimate if I got the thing based on the clinical data, I'd probably be about 10% likely to die. You know, nearly 50, fat, out of shape, some lung problems. That's really not a great place to be. On the other hand, you know, I'm also kind of tank-like because up until I was 30, you know, I had 22 years of martial arts experience by the time I was 30. So I was pretty in shape when I was younger. But after I got that lung infection, I was really never the same again. So, you know, if you look at a model where half of the population gets infected, and I reckon I've got a 10% mortality rate, there's on the order of a 5% chance I don't make it to the end of this year, right? For the people that have that elevated risk, and they all fit into that category, this whole thing is very, very life and death, at the same time where it's completely insignificant to people that are 50 years younger. If you're 12 years old, there's practically no chances will affect you severely, right? Whereas your grandparents, if they get it, you know, they're 20-30% likely to die, right? And that structural tear in the experience between the generations, I think the single hardest thing for Americans to deal with, because I think it's going to require a washing of all of the intergenerational laundry to get cooperation between the generations in a way that allows the sort of smooth, integrated family functioning that we're going to need to get through this without a bunch of unnecessary deaths and infections. Everybody's going to have to go home and do their laundry with their parents and with their kids to get to the point where people will tell the truth to each other and they can make plans together as a family for what is going to be a difficult year and a dangerous one for the elders.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and you thought it was just going to be masks and gloves. No, no, it's much worse. We have to do our emotional homework too.
Right, and you were saying a lot about this on your Twitter feed, and I would actually like encourage people to follow Vinay on Twitter. He's had some great insights into what could happen in society structurally, and I think these are very real things that if we're not thinking about, we're probably going to be thinking about them as soon as they happen. So be, you know, just like mentally prepare yourself, I think is a good thing to say. And yeah. Appreciate you taking the time once again.
Very welcome. Very welcome. Because I mean, the thing is that people think that this is about masks and gloves and hand sanitizer, and it is about those things, but masks and gloves and hand sanitizer and the rest of that, those things are shopping problems. If you've got the stuff, you get as much safety as the stuff will give you. If you don't got the stuff, you don't go outside, you improvise, you wash your hands, you wrap a t-shirt around your face, wherever it happens to be, you know, it's really about a level of comfort with your equipment. And that's a relatively simple mechanical technocratic process, right? I would say a week or 2 weeks from now, we'll have largely figured that stuff out. The supply chain will have begun to sort itself out. The mask guys will have gone back into high production. One way or the other, we will have gotten that sorted out to a first approximation. The much harder problems about infection control in a very stressed society. You know, my colleague Anton Shalapanov has just written a piece which is based on his years of experience helping in prisons about how to do infection control based on the models they use for HIV and tuberculosis. Because it turns out that the criminal justice system is like an enormous infection accelerator, because people go in, they get infected while they're on remand, they come out again, and then they bring it back to their communities. So there's a paper which will shortly be up on the Materium website. We'll put a link to it on resiliencemaps.org as well, where, you know, like, pre-existing social problem turns out to be a vector for transmission. So it's like social distancing is one approach. The other thing that you have to do is you have to close up all the cracks in your society where you can get dishonesty or conflict or people not working together, lack of cooperation. You have to sew up all of those open wounds, you know, disinfect, clean, treat, so that when people do have to work together, they're not clearing up 30 years of emotional garbage unhashed out between generations since, you know, something bad happened in 1994. Like, you want to get that stuff cleaned out, because if you're in a position where, you know, your parent calls you and says, I need help, you're going to have to make a decision about whether or not the risk of you going over there is worth it or not. And that requires you and the person you're talking to be fully open and honest and tell the truth to each other. You can't have the shadows of the past distorting the communication and still get optimal outcomes when people have to work together in a life or death situation, which is all of us for the rest of this year.
Wow. Thank you, Vinay. I appreciate once again you taking the time out. I know you've got a lot of important work to do, and you know, we all have important decisions and things to think about. So thank you so much once again.
Very welcome. You know, what's the good night and good luck, or keep calm and carry on? We need, you know, we need a phrase like that for the flu. We haven't got it yet, but we'll find one.
Yeah, we don't. We do need something though. You're right. Yeah. All right, thank you.
Right, well, splendid. Thank you, too, for taking the time. I mean, these stories don't get told unless somebody, you know, puts a mic in front of me and says, okay, tell me what you think about this. You know, this stuff just stays inside of my head. So thank you for taking the time.
No problem.